From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As Fresh Air's hometown prepares to host the Republican National Convention, we talked to Dave Davies of the Philadelphia Daily News about how Philadelphia won the bid to host the convention, what's at stake for the city, and what the city has had to do to prepare. Also, the life and work of a quintessentially American composer, Aaron Copland. This year marks the centennial of his birth. We'll talk with his biographer, Howard Pollack. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The French agency in charge of investigating Tuesday's Concorde crash has released preliminary information from the flight recorders. Both left engines were malfunctioning at takeoff. NPR's Sarah Chase reports from Paris.
According to a statement released by the Accident Investigation Bureau, the in-flight data recorder shows not only that engine number 2 broke down, but engine number 1 next to it on the wing also failed, then seemed to revive, then after 1 minute of flight it failed again. After that, the Concorde heeled to the left and crashed. Engine number 2 was the one that had repair work done just before takeoff. Also, according to the Bureau, the crew can be heard on the in-flight voice recorder saying the landing gear wouldn't stow. The statement describes a trail of wreckage leading all the way from the runway to the field where the plane crashed, including, of note, bits of tire found on the runway. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Paris.
Marine Corps investigators say human errors caused the crash that killed all 19 Marines aboard an Osprey aircraft in April. The general in charge of marine aviation told reporters today that the pilots of the Osprey descended too quickly, causing the plane to flip over and crash. The Osprey is designed to take off and land like a helicopter, but fly like a plane. On Capitol Hill, a key senator said today that any funding increases Congress provides this year for nursing homes should be tied to increased staffing. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
One of the few health bills Congress is expected to pass this fall would provide billions of dollars to health care providers to make up for deeper-than-intended cuts imposed in 1997. At a hearing Thursday, Aging Committee Chairman Charles Grassley of Iowa said that nursing homes should not share in that money unless they use it to hire more staff. Grassley's comments came at a hearing to receive a draft report from the Department of Health and Human Services that for the first time documents the link between inadequate staffing and quality problems in the nation's nursing homes. Researchers who worked on the report told the committee that facilities with lower than recommended staffing levels had much higher rates of complications, including bed sores, pneumonia, and avoidable hospitalizations. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
The White House says it's encouraged by word that Israel and the Palestinians plan to resume peace talks this weekend. The plan comes just days after a two-week summit meeting at President Clinton's retreat in Maryland failed to produce an agreement. The two sides have set themselves a deadline of September 13th to reach agreement on issues that include the future of Jerusalem and the rights of Palestinian refugees. In stocks today, the Dow gained 70 points to close at 10,586. The Nasdaq lost 145 points to close at 3842. This is NPR News. Lawyers for Napster have asked a federal appeals court to stay a judge's order that would shut the internet music service down. In response to a lawsuit filed by the Recording Industry Association of America, U.S. District Judge Marilyn Hall Patel said Napster's song trading service encouraged users to infringe on music copyrights. In their appeal, Napster lawyers said that the decision would drive their company out of business within days and deprive more than 20 million users of the company's service. Today, users crowded Napster and similar services to exchange music before the deadline that would shut Napster down. Prosecutors in Southern California are going to offer free DNA tests to some prison inmates for the first time in the nation. NPR's Aaron Schachter reports.
San Diego prosecutors have been reviewing the cases of more than 550 inmates. DNA testing was developed after their convictions, which all occurred prior to 1992. Test results may be used to link biological evidence from a crime scene to someone other than the person now serving time. The belief is those findings might overturn some convictions. Similar initiatives are in the planning stages in other parts of California, as well as in Illinois and Texas. DNA tests on the inmates will cost about $5,000 each. Meanwhile, the Justice Department has been conducting seminars for law enforcement agencies about the evolving use of DNA evidence. Aaron Schachter, NPR News.
Ford said today that it plans to boost the gasoline mileage of its sport utility vehicles by 25% over the next 5 years. The SUVs are Ford's least fuel-efficient vehicles, but they're among its best sellers. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air's hometown, Philadelphia, is about to play host to tens of thousands of Republicans, media people, and protesters. The city is preparing for everything from traffic jams and crowded restaurants to demonstrations of civil disobedience. Why do cities compete so vigorously to host a political convention? And what did Philadelphia offer in order to win? My guest Dave Davies is a longtime reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News. He covered the administration of Mayor Ed Rendell, which put together the convention package, and he's covering the current mayor, John Street. It's somewhat ironic that Rendell, who convinced the Republicans to come here, is now the head of the Democratic National Committee. But Rendell felt so strongly about the city hosting a convention, he pitched both parties.
One of the things about Ed Rendell is that he's just an audacious sort of guy who gets an idea and goes with it. And he was really excited about the city and some of the things that were happening in the city, and felt that it would be a great place that anybody would want to visit, and Republicans would like it too. He also saw the political logic of Pennsylvania being a swing state, which Republicans need in a national convention, and thought that would be a selling point. When I did some early reporting on the city's effort to get the convention, I was really surprised to hear what the business is like, at least since the 90s. I mean, both parties issue specific requirements on what you're expected to provide if you want to even be considered for a convention. They want you to have 20,000, 25,000 hotel rooms within a half an hour. They want 100 air-conditioned buses for delegates. They want first-class travel and hotel accommodations for as many visits as the site selection committee wants to make to your city. And the other thing that surprised me was a financial package in the tens of millions of dollars. These things are expensive to put on, and the parties have learned, just as baseball sports franchises have learned and other institutions, that cities will pay.
What do you mean by a financial package? What does that mean?
It means cash for it means cash and services to cover the huge costs of putting on an event of this scale. Money for security, for transportation, for insurance. You have to build a 150,000 square foot media area for the 15,000 journalists that'll be there filing and setting up their satellite trucks. The traffic controls, the security concerns, all those things have to be provided. It runs in the tens of millions, and in the case of Philadelphia, the package that was put together totaled $52 million. Now, that wasn't all public money. Most of it wasn't. About $7 million was from the city, about $7 million was from the state, but the rest of it was from private corporations. And I think the Republican committee loved the city. I think I was here when the site selection committee came in June, and it was a beautiful, bright, sunny day when they were at the Independence historical area and taking carriage rides around, and it can be kind of a magical place at those moments. But the money really mattered.
Now, when you talk about the money, is this all like money in services, or is there any like direct cash that changes hands?
A lot of it's direct services, such as police overtime, traffic control. But the bulk of the money that is contributed by the host community goes through a quasi-public corporation that is the host committee. In this case, it's called Philadelphia 2000, and they raise and spend a ton of money in putting this on.
So is this considered a campaign contribution?
That's an issue. There are those in Common Cause and elsewhere who think it's an outrage to have corporations and governments contributing money on the scale of tens of millions to an explicitly partisan political event. And they have a point. The Federal Election Commission does permit this use. And it sort of makes distinctions between political uses of that money and non-political uses. It would be a political use to make a video of the candidate, which is shown on convention night. It's maybe a non-political use to provide media space. But in the minds of critics, I mean, it's that distinction gets kind of specious. I mean, the fact is that corporations are barred from contributing to, you know, federal election campaigns, but they're permitted to contribute in great measure to hosting a convention, which, it can be argued, saves the party in question that money from contributing to the political campaign. I have to say, on the other side of the issue, that the convention is, in fact, kind of it does generate jobs. I mean, it is an economic development opportunity and something which can boost the self-image of the community. So I don't think that a lot of corporations that give do so for other reasons other than that. They think that it is good for the city.
One of the promises that was made to the GOP was that Philadelphia would have 2,000 more rooms by the year 2000 than it had a couple of years ago when it was making the deal with the Republicans to have the convention here. And I think Philadelphia got the rooms. What did it do to get more hotel rooms?
You know, that was a promise that was made, but it really... That's one thing that the host committee and the mayor couldn't make happen by themselves. The reason that there's a growth in hotel construction in Philadelphia is that the city is doing well. I mean, the downtown is really bustling. The tourism and hospitality industry has gotten a nice kick from a convention center which opened in 1993. And there are things going on here that people are kind of excited about. And a booming national economy has helped generate the economic kind of climate that hotels could build in. Now, the city did do what it could. I mean, and the mayor did offer tax breaks to a number of these hotels, but they wouldn't have happened on that basis alone. I have to say that one of the other thing that's the other things that I think sold the site selection committee is that a lot of these new hotels are in old buildings which have been renovated. And that sort of fits with what Philadelphia has to offer that's unique, the sense of 19th century and early 20th century architecture, a sense of heritage. One of the hotels that's right across from where I work at the City Hall Bureau of my newspaper used to be the old City Hall Annex. It was this musty, asbestos-laden, rat-infested dump, and it's been taken over by the Marriott Corporation, and these beautiful stone Romanesque arches are cleaned and all the brass is polished, and it looks great, and it looks great in a way that a new hotel often doesn't in the Sun Belt. And I think that kind of stuff really impressed the site selection committee.
Dave Davies is my guest, and he's a longtime reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News, and he's been covering a lot of the city's preparations for the Republican National Convention. With the national media focusing on the city of Philadelphia, the city is, of course, hoping for, you know, really good publicity, but there have been a couple of events recently that have had the opposite effect, particularly an event involving the Philadelphia police. Do you want to describe what happened, Dave?
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. What viewers around the nation have seen on television is a videotape of police surrounding. This is taken overhead from a television station's helicopter. Of police pulling a carjacking suspect out of a car, surrounding him, and kicking him for about 30 seconds, administering 50 or so blows before it eventually stops and the suspect is taken away. Because it is very dramatic video, it got very, very wide play. I think it's kind of there's no doubt that it's unfortunate that this happened just as the Republicans are about to come. Unfortunate for the city. But I also think that it's unfortunate that the whole story is not widely circulated. It becomes treated as a Rodney King, too, and it really isn't. I mean, this was a large guy with a long criminal record who was seen in a stolen car, led police on a dangerous high-speed chase through a residential neighborhood, was stopped, fought the police, managed to get away, steal a police car, drive on another high-speed chase. And when he was finally cornered, he was pulled out. The video shows the beating occurring. What you can't see because the officers are standing over the suspect is what the suspect is doing. And, in fact, the pile, if you look at it, is kind of moving. And what the officer's lawyer has said is that the suspect was fighting, resisting, kicking. In fact, that he had his teeth clenched around one of the officer's hands. And, in fact, one of the officers was treated for a human bite afterwards. So that in the officer's defense, what you could say was this was a guy who was fighting him and who had his teeth clenched in one of their one of the cops, and they were kicking him to get him to release him to get him under control. And once that happened, they let him go. Now, we're going to figure out what happened. I mean, there will be other witnesses, and I suspect that there will be a sense that there was police success here. I mean, there were reports that he had shot a police officer in the hand before. It's not clear whether that happened or whether it was crossfire. But there's no question that the video is dramatic, and it shows a lot of police violence against this guy. And it's it does not help the city as it begins to host a convention in which police conduct in mass protests are a concern.
Your paper, the Philadelphia Daily News, had a cover story that had a photo of the police beating with the headline, "Welcome America." Was there a lot of editorial conversation about whether to run that headline or not?
The headlines are picked by guys who work late at night when the moon comes up, and it's time to make a splash and get impulse buyers of the newspaper, and so things like that happen. The other thing happens, and this is sort of a comment about the way the media works these days, a newspaper has to offer something different. And by the time people were going to be buying our newspaper, they would have seen that video many, many times, anybody who's remotely aware of the news. What the newspaper was attempting to do there was to make a connection between this now widely known beating and the fact that we are about to be in the national spotlight and the Republicans are coming. So it was a way of kind of expressing that connection in a really arresting way. And we caught a lot of grief for it.
From readers?
From readers, from city officials who literally stopped by to complain about it. It's the kind of difficulty that you have in reporting on controversial events. And I think a lot of folks felt, some folks at least felt, that the paper went over the line there.
My guest is Dave Davies, a longtime reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about how Philadelphia won the bid to host the Republican convention and what it's had to do to prepare. My guest is Dave Davies of the Philadelphia Daily News. Well, Philadelphia is not only going to be hosting the Republican National Convention, it's going to be hosting a lot of really large demonstrations during the convention, and there will be protesters from around the country coming here. So there'll be a lot of attention on how the Philadelphia police handles those protests. The protests are supposed to be officially confined to an area near the convention. One umbrella group sued for the right to protest in the streets of the city. They won, and there will be a large rally in the city on the streets on Sunday. And then there are other protests that will go ahead without permits. And I think everybody's wondering, how will the police respond to these unpermitted protests? What has the mayor had to say about this, Dave? You've covered City Hall for a long time, and the mayor of Philadelphia is John Street, who's a Democrat, former member of City Council, and a former activist.
Yeah, he many, many years ago, I mean, he chained himself to the railing of City Council and held street demonstrations on behalf of street vendors. I mean, he is an old activist himself, although he has for many years been a fairly traditional politician. He has not handled this particularly deftly. He made the mistake of saying in front of a reporter for George Magazine that folks who come here and want to disrupt are going to get a very ugly response. It was a poor choice of words, and in fact, what the mayor also said in that meeting was that he fully believes in the First Amendment and folks' rights to protest, and he is going to do everything he can, not only to make sure that protesters aren't abused, but in fact to make them feel welcome. I mean, the city's planning to, at its own expense, provide portable toilets and drinking water if it's hot and other amenities. So I think the mayor does have a feeling that people expressing their views, and he's always been this way, is a good thing. But his poor choice of words in the magazine was not good, and I think he didn't do a particularly job of handling the gaffe afterward.
Mm-hmm. Philadelphia has been described in a lot of the national press as having undergone a big economic revival. As someone who's covered the city for a long time and covered city politics for a long time, how much of an economic revival do you think the city has undergone?
It's real. You know, I mean, this is a city that at the beginning of the 19th century was the second largest English-speaking city in the world after London. But in the last half of the 20th century, the kind of economic decline and the loss of industrial opportunity that afflicted all these northeastern cities has left this a relatively poor city and a declining city. And it's also suffered from a self-image problem. It's kind of stuck between New York and Washington, which are these great kind of centers of culture and politics. It's not even on the weather maps in CNN, for example. I mean, it tends to be forgotten. It tends to feel forgotten. By the 1990s, the city was completely broke and dispirited. And Mayor Rendell came in 1992, and what has happened has been genuine and real. I mean, there was some steps taken to right the city's economy. The unions made some changes in benefits and work rules. And the mayor just worked hard. I mean, he had a very talented bunch of people. They managed the finances well, improved services a bit, actually began cutting the city's wage tax just a bit, which is kind of unheard of. And that, aided by the good luck of a national economic recovery, meant that the city really got going. I mean, there has been a lot of growth downtown, but huge problems remain. While the city's job growth has actually stopped, it continues to lose population. The school system is both broke and dysfunctional, and too many people still feel unsafe. Too many middle-class families are still fleeing to the suburbs, so the challenges are huge.
You know, we've been talking a little bit about how everybody will be watching how the Philadelphia police handles the protests. And, of course, the image that's in the nation's mind right now is the image of the video in which the police were kicking the suspect. But there's also, like, a long-term image of the Philadelphia police that goes back to the Rizzo era, from the days before he was mayor, when he was police commissioner, and he was, like, the tough law and order head cop, and was kind of proud of the aggressive ways in which protesters were treated. What would you say about the reputation of the Philadelphia police now and of its pretty new police commissioner?
Well, it was getting better until we saw the video. Back in the 1970s, when a tough-talking former cop, Frank Rizzo, was mayor, the city was actually sued by the Justice Department for an ongoing pattern of police brutality. That changed when he left office. But then in the mid-1980s, there was this disastrous confrontation with a radical group in West Philadelphia, which ended in a fire that destroyed 61 homes and killed 11 people. That didn't help. And there have been ongoing cases of police corruption and brutality over the years. The city's new police commissioner, John Timoney, was probably the most highly regarded kind of available cop in the country when he was hired 2 years ago, and has gotten high marks from both community leaders and police reform advocates for trying to make the cops more honest, more accountable, more efficient, more responsive. And I think most folks believe that he has taken real steps in that direction. His response to the beating has been to say, anybody who's done wrong is going to be punished, but you've got to give me time to investigate it. And I think community leaders have, in the main, been satisfied with that. And this will be a real challenge, because what he has to do in handling these protesters is to maintain order, not abuse the rights of the protesters, and not be seen as abusing them, and yet somehow prevent the kind of chaos which really damaged Seattle in the World Trade Conference. And I think that kind of the kinds of protesters we're seeing present a much more challenging situation for cops than maybe they did 10 years ago.
Philadelphia landed the Republican convention before the World Trade Organization protests in Seattle and before it kind of realized that big events like this were going to be a magnet for this new network of political protesters. And I'm wondering if you've been hearing any second thoughts about getting the convention here now that we know that Philadelphia is going to be the site of some major demonstrations.
No, I haven't heard anybody saying that they wish we hadn't done it, but you do hear nervousness. I mean, you know, people are worried that folks who are prepared to kind of use the anonymity of a crowd situation and are willing to get arrested and really kind of don't particularly care who they offend or hurt are a tough bunch for police to deal with. So I think there is nervousness about it.
Just as a little scene setting, we'll all be watching the convention inside what is now called the First Union Center, which has had several other names in the past few years.
The protesters refer to it as the FU Center, right?
But tell us a little bit about this center, how it also functions as a sports arena and where it's located, what's in the neighborhood around there.
Yeah. The First Union Center was built in the early 90s as a home for the Philadelphia 76ers and the Philadelphia Flyers. It's one of the big, new, modern 20,000-seat sports arenas, which also hosts, you know, the circus and rock bands from time to time. It's not downtown, which was a bit of a disadvantage. It's about 4 or 5 miles connected by a subway to the southern end of the city, where it is fairly near some row house communities who have long been troubled by the amount of traffic and parking issues that it brings. But that's where delegates will go from hotels throughout the area and downtown by these air-conditioned convention buses, which the Republican National Committee requires the host city to provide. They'll go to the center. In the parking lot outside the center is a massive temporary structure built to house some of the 15,000 journalists who will need working space to cover this event. It's interesting. The organizers don't like you calling it a tent, but it is, in fact, a large canvas-covered semi-permanent structure that will be taken down once the convention is over with. In effect, you end up with a small city in this sea of parking lots in South Philadelphia, which will be the center of activity for these 4 days, and then it'll return to normal and back to the city sports franchises.
Philadelphia is a very democratic city, and so it's kind of paradoxical that it's hosting this Republican convention. I'm wondering if you think a lot of the people in Philadelphia who are so excited about the convention coming see it more as just like a big event that might generate good feeling toward Philadelphia and business in Philadelphia, as opposed to seeing it as a political event in which, you know, the outside party is coming here to organize.
Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly the way it's seen. It's like getting the Super Bowl or the All-Star game. And it'll be interesting, in fact, when the TV coverage showcases a lot of hard-hitting partisan speeches by Republicans, whether some of the folks who had been excited about this aren't just a little turned off. But, yeah, no, it's really for the city. It has really little to do with ideology or candidate or campaign. It really is a big event. It's a chance for the city to shine.
Dave Davies writes for the Philadelphia Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of Turn of the Century, a novel by Kurt Anderson. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, the life and music of Aaron Copland. We talk with his biographer, Howard Pollack. This year marks the centennial of Copland's birth. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. That's the opening of Fanfare for the Common Man, one of Aaron Copland's most famous compositions. It was written in 1942 as one of a series of wartime fanfares commissioned by the Cincinnati Symphony. This year, orchestras around the country are celebrating the centenary of Copland's birth. My guest is the author of a recent biography of Copland, Howard Pollack. He's a professor of music history and literature at the University of Houston. In an era when classical music meant European music, Copland was determined to create a distinctly American sound, which he succeeded in doing by drawing on jazz, folk music, and hymns. Some of his most famous music was written for ballets, such as Rodeo, Billy the Kid, and Appalachian Spring. Let's start with one of his early works, which shows the influence of jazz. It was written in 1925, when Copland was 25. This is an excerpt of Music for the Theater. Howard Pollack, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks very much.
You know, although Copland is so loved for writing music that really sounds like America, he was accused of being anti-American during the red-baiting era of the 1950s. You cover some of that in your biography of Copland, and you say that for him this kind of started in 1949 with a Life magazine article that singled him and about 49 other people out. This was an article called Red Visitors Cause Rumpus, Dupes and Fellow Travelers Dress Up Communist Fronts. This was an article about a World Peace Conference in New York that featured photos of 50 of the conference's best-known participants, including Copland, Bernstein, Charles Chaplin, Einstein, Lillian Hellman, Thomas Mann, and Arthur Miller. What was the importance of this article?
Well, it was a landmark article in the history of the anti-communist hysteria that gripped America during these years, and it was a tremendous personal embarrassment for Copland. He never dreamed that his participation in this event could be interpreted in this way. It didn't augur very well for the next few years.
Copland was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee. How did he handle himself when he was interrogated?
Oh, he handled himself as he always did, with extreme poise and calm. And I think he very successfully managed to disarm Joe McCarthy and the other members of that committee.
Did he name names?
He did not name names and was very clever about sort of getting around the request for naming names. For instance, I think they... There was a question asked about his participation in an event. It might have been the World Peace Conference. I don't recall offhand. And he said, I don't remember seeing anybody there that wasn't mentioned in the newspaper. So that was the sort of very sly and clever way he handled the committee.
Were there attempts to suppress his music during this period?
There were a few. The most notorious was the removal of Lincoln Portrait from the inaugural concert, from the Eisenhower inaugural concert in 1952. The Congress thought that someone with these type of questionable associations, these questionable leftist associations, should not have his music performed at an inaugural concert. And it was meant, this decision was met with great outrage and satirical comments by the press, by and large, because people knew that this was, this whole thing was a sham. Lincoln Portrait is one of the great, great works of American music, and a very profoundly, you know, stirring setting of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address and other of Lincoln's statements. But politicians really didn't know Copeland very well and just went along with the hysteria that was, as I said, gripping America at the time.
What were Copeland's politics?
Copeland was definitely a man of the left. He was very concerned about the common man. He wrote a fanfare, a very famous fanfare for the common man. And I think that was one of the great motivating aspects of his life, his work as an artist, his work in the social arena as a conductor, as a writer, were all geared toward raising the standards and the of the arts in America, making art available to Americans, fostering good music in America. I think this all had a sort of social and political subtext and connection.
I'm wondering if the staunch anti-communists and the people on the House Un-American Activity Committee knew that Copeland was gay, something that they also probably would have been hysterical about.
There's no evidence of that in the FBI file, but it's very possible that they did. He didn't make a great secret of being gay.
Now, you write a bit about Copeland's homosexuality, and you say that that he accepted that himself at a pretty young age, at a time when a lot of gay people didn't accept homosexuality because it was so unaccepted by the world around them. What evidence do you have that he was comfortable with his own sexual orientation?
The primary evidence consists of statements that his very good friend Harold Clurman made. Harold Clurman was the great director and drama critic. There's a Harold Clurman Theater in New York. And Clurman and Copeland were roommates. They were cousins. They were also roommates in Paris from 1921 to 1924. So Clurman is one of his oldest friends and wrote about Copeland's acceptance of his homosexuality. Other composers, writers who entered his circle either intimated or stated or spoke about Copeland's comfort with his homosexuality and how important that was for them, because he was someone, whether they were gay or straight, he was someone that they could turn to for support because he was so confident with himself and had such self-assurance about his own person.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Howard Pollack, the author of a biography of Aaron Copeland. Pollack is also a professor of music at the University of Houston. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Howard Pollack, the author of a biography of Aaron Copeland. He's also a professor of music at the University of Houston. One of the things I find almost paradoxical about Copeland is that on the one hand, he's writing, you know, American music. And by American music, this often translates to music of the West, you know, like Rodeo and Billy the Kid. And then there's, you know, like Mexican themes running through some of his music. And there's Copeland himself, who's, you know, the son of Russian immigrants. He's Jewish. He's gay. He's from Brooklyn, New York. And, you know, I know he wants to write, like, American music, but what's his connection to the West, you know, to the American West? Was he ever even in that part of the country?
he was in that part of the country. And everyone in America, I think, knows about the West. He grew up with watching Westerns and silent films. And
I always think of Westerns as being later on. I guess he could have watched those Western silent films. I don't want people to take this the wrong way. I'm not trying to say, where did he get off as a Jewish homosexual from Brooklyn writing about the West? But it's rather, how did he feel so connected to it when it really wasn't a part of his personal background?
Well, the importance of the West is perhaps in a way exaggerated by the fact that some of his most famous pieces are on Western themes that were written for choreographers who were writing ballets about the West. If one looks at the total output of Copland's music, the West really doesn't figure very prominently. But because of the prominence of Billy the Kid and Rodeo and Appalachian Spring, three ballets he wrote in succession in the late 1930s and early 1940s, his name, I think, forever will be associated with the West.
And again, this is because he was commissioned to write these pieces.
He was commissioned to write them. There's a comical story about discussing Rodeo with Agnes DeMille, and Agnes DeMille outlined her idea about this cowboy ballet. Copland had already written a cowboy ballet, Billy the Kid, and thought one cowboy ballet in a lifetime is enough and was rather resistant. And Agnes DeMille, in trying to win him over, said, but it will have something of what Martha Graham, who was her friend, what Martha Graham calls race memory. To which Copland responded, well, why then don't we do a ballet about Ellis Island, referring to the fact that Agnes DeMille had a Jewish grandmother who is the mother of Cecil B. DeMille, the great film director. And so Copland was rather ironic about this. However, Agnes DeMille won him over. She had created this wonderful comic persona as a cowgirl who was a little bit big in the hips and didn't move that gracefully, and it was a wonderful comic persona. And she convinced Copland to write a ballet for that persona, for that stage character, and Copland responded with Rodeo.
Well, why don't we hear a passage from Rodeo? What should we hear? Hoedown?
Hoedown sounds great.
Okay. And this is Leonard Bernstein conducting. Leonard Bernstein conducting Aaron Copland's Rodeo. My guest is Howard Pollack, who's written a biography of Aaron Copland, and he's a professor of music at the University of Houston. What was his attitude toward Hollywood when he was writing movie music? And before you answer that, tell us some of the best scores that he wrote for movies.
He wrote five Hollywood scores of Mice and Men, including the Of Mice and Men, Our Town, The North Star, The Heiress, and The Red Pony, and all of them won Academy Award nominations, finally won by the last film, The Heiress. Copland had a very balanced view of life, including film music. He recognized that most people were hearing, in America and maybe around the world, were hearing orchestral music in the movie house. So he recognized the importance of film music in American society and in world society. That made him very interested in trying his hand out as a film composer. That said, he also recognized that there were a lot of pitfalls for a serious idealistic artist like himself in Hollywood, and he kind of proceeded very carefully in his Hollywood career, making sure he would be working with certain directors and making sure he'd be working on certain projects. And in fact, a very unpleasant incident about The Heiress was one of the reasons probably he gave up writing films, film scores for Hollywood.
What was that incident?
The opening title music that he had written, which is very, very strong, powerful music to help set the mood for this really wonderful film adaptation of the Henry James story, was rewritten by a studio hack into a kind of schmaltzy, typical Hollywood opening. And if you watch The Heiress, you'll notice that when the titles read music by Aaron Copland, the score suddenly changes, and it's like somebody's just thrown cold water over you, because that's the beginning of Copland's own score and his own music, which is much more severe and hard-edged than one had heard up until that point. Copland was so disgusted with Hollywood for doing that he wrote, he just publicly criticized the studios, and this probably led to such bad feelings that it became difficult for him to work in Hollywood. Not that people did not ask him to work in the ensuing years.
Let's hear the opening music from The Heiress as audiences heard it when watching the movie, and then we'll hear what Copland intended, and we'll hear that conducted by Leonard Slatkin. Aaron Copland's theme for The Heiress, as he composed it, preceded by the rewritten version used on the soundtrack of the film. My guest, Howard Pollack, is the author of a recent biography of Aaron Copland. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
This year marks the centenary of Aaron Copland's birth. My guest Howard Pollack is the author of a biography of the composer. The Copland work that we've been hearing has, for the most part, been his really accessible, popular music. Now, he also wrote some more contemporary-sounding classical music, using, like, the 12-tone row, for instance. Some people think of that as being kind of out of character for him or being less important or less interesting than his more, say, jazz-oriented work and his dance suites. Why don't we hear the very ending of his piece Connotations for Orchestra, which was commissioned in 1962 to open what was then called Philharmonic Hall and is now Avery Fisher Hall, which is part of Lincoln Center. What are your thoughts about the ending of this piece and the importance of this piece in his larger output of work?
Well, Connotations represents, in a way, the extreme of this spectrum, because it really is one of the thorniest and most difficult works of Copland. Every once in a while, he gave in to a work that seemed to express a good deal of violence and harshness, people have interpreted this as Copland taking stock of the world that we live in, and it's not always nostalgic reflections of a previous day, but rather gritty reflections on our own day, and I think Connotations falls into that category.
And the end, you know, challenging as it may be, the end is really rousing and noisy and interesting.
Copland's always noisy, I think. This is one of the earmarks of his music, is it's extremely vital and vibrant with lots of percussion instruments. And his music often concludes in this sort of arousing way.
Okay, here's the end of Aaron Copland's Connotations for Orchestra. Ending of Aaron Copland's Connotations for Orchestra as conducted by Leonard Bernstein. Bernstein and Copland had a very important musical relationship. Bernstein conducted a lot of Copland. He premiered some of Copland's pieces. Would you tell us a little bit more about their relationship to each other, what they thought of each other musically?
Copland was by far the most important person professionally in Leonard Bernstein's career, especially as a composer. Bernstein discovered Copland's music while he was still in college. They became personal buddies when Bernstein, again, was still in college. And Copland really mentored Bernstein, and Bernstein developed a musical style that grew directly out of Copland's music. West Side Story, for instance, is inconceivable without the example of Copland's music. So Bernstein was one of many American composers who had an enormous debt to Copland as a composer.
What do you know what he thought of, say, West Side Story, which is a really wonderful work, you know, the score for that, but it is very, very much out of Copland.
Copland did not write very much about Bernstein's music. His only extended piece on Bernstein is an earlier work in which he sort of criticizes the eclecticism of his music, but praises its vigor and panache. He predicts in the late 40s, from when this article is from, that Bernstein's greatest success is likely to be in the theater. So he was right on that score.
Mm-hmm. Copland died in 1990 at the age of 90. He had suffered a form of dementia for several years. Did the public know about that?
The public really didn't know about his dementia. It was more or less, you know, kept from public view. There were a few late episodes in Copeland's career when it was clear that he did not have all his faculties, and the press were beginning to comment on that. And at a certain point, he just had no contact with the public.
Do you know if during that period he had any music abilities left, whether he listened to music or could play, if he took any pleasure in music?
He did take pleasure in music. People report that he would tap his fingers listening to music, or tap even without listening to music. You know, the pianist's habit of kind of tapping his fingers on the keyboard. He listened to music, and he seemed to enjoy hearing music and would smile, and to the end kept a certain very agreeable countenance about him that he was always known for, this kind of toothy, grinny, smiling face that everyone knows to be Copeland's public face.
Would you like to choose a piece for us to close with, a piece that you particularly love, that you'd like to share with us?
I have to admit a special fondness for Appalachian Spring. As popular as that work is, it's a work that one can go back to time and time again and hear something new always.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about Aaron
Copeland. It's been my pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Howard Pollack is the author of Aaron Copeland, The Life and Work of an Uncommon Man. Pollack is a professor at the University of Houston. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Roberta Shurrock, with Patty Leswing and Megan Howell. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, actor John C. Reilly. He's currently starring in The Perfect Storm. He also starred in Magnolia, which was just released on video. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.